good New Year's resolution can make you healthier or happier, but a great resolution could even make you a bit richer. A survey conducted last year by Maris Poll found that 44% of adults in the U.S. planned on making a New Year's resolution for 2018. So how has it been going? No, really, let's talk about it on this edition of On Your Money. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Kevin McKinley is a financial planner and managing member of McKinley Money LLC. Kevin, welcome back.
Hello, Kate.
And if you have a personal finance question for Kevin McKinley, you can ask away, 800-642-1234. Do you have a question about a money-related New Year's resolution? Email it to onyourmoney@wpr.org. You can tweet us at WPR Mornings. Well, we might need some motivation to stick to our New Year's resolution. That's a fairly common scenario, isn't it, Kevin?
It is, Kate. And according to a poll from the website YouGov, the top three resolutions for 2018 and most other years were to eat healthier, get more exercise, and save more money. But another survey from Statistic Brain says that 40% of people who do set New Year's resolutions drop them by now, by the end of January.
So how can we help listeners stick to those resolutions?
One way to do it is to show them the advantages of tying them together. There was a study conducted by Johns Hopkins and published in the research journal entitled Obesity. And it said that reducing your body mass index can save money. Now, BMI isn't the perfect measure of weight or fitness, but it is a good proxy for how you're doing. And what they found is that losing a little weight in the form of a lower BMI can save you money in health expenses, lost wages, productivity, health insurance premiums. And for instance, they found that a 20-year-old who has a BMI greater than 30, if he or she were to lower that BMI to under 30, he or she would save $17,000 over his or her lifetime. And if they can get it down below 25, they'll save $28,000. And a 50-year-old who can reduce his or her BMI, body mass index, by 5 points, which is a pretty considerable drop, but who can reduce it by 5 points could save $36,000 in out-of-pocket healthcare expenses, lost wages, productivity, and health insurance premiums.
But we have to separate it out here because losing weight and saving money are two different goals.
Two very different goals. But, of course, it involves a lot of discipline. It's very simple to figure out how to do it, but it's not easy. And if it were, we'd all be thin and rich. You can use the same methods, though, to do both. You first of all, start off by setting your goal, whether it's losing 10 pounds by a certain date or maybe putting aside $1,000 extra over 6 months, and then use a diary or a chart to show your progress. And I've even seen people who have just bought a pad of graph paper and plotted each point every single day. And then tracked their eating and their spending so they can see what they can cut. And then they journal their exercises and they measure their weight every single day. And so they have a visual, tangible accountability for what their progress has been. And then in terms of saving money and also trying to lose weight, set some real basic rules where you would stop eating out. Restaurants are very good at creating very enticing food that generally has way more calories than we need or want to add if we're trying to lose weight. And don't buy the junk in boxes at the grocery store that generally is overpriced but not very good for you. It's a lot more expensive than the Whole Foods you might find in the perimeter of the supermarket. And finally, only carry cash with you wherever you go. That limits your spending automatically. It creates a sense of panic when you get to the checkout line and say, oh, I have $84 of items with me. I only have $80, but that's a good way to limit your cash. And if you're feeling hungry or you feel like you want to go spend some money, go for a workout or just take a very long walk and kind of exhaust yourself until the mood passes.
Any other tricks and tips to get healthier and save some money?
Sure. There are several apps out there that involve money and fitness. Like one is called Sweatcoin, which purports to track your movement outside in steps and then gives you kind of almost a Bitcoin-like payment that you can use to purchase goods and services at various websites for it. You do have to give up a lot of your privacy because it's obviously monitoring your movements. And then several other ones involve the notion of putting money up and setting a goal for losing weight. And if you lose the weight, you get your money back, or maybe you get more money from other users who haven't been successful. And those include Pact, Healthy Wage, and Diet Bet. And we'll put links to those websites at our website, onyourmoney.com, later on today.
Kevin McKinley is the managing member of McKinley Money LLC, a registered investment advisor with offices in Eau Claire and Madison. Kevin McKinley does not intend to provide personalized investment advice through this broadcast and does not represent that the securities or services discussed are suitable for any investor. Investors should consult with their financial advisors prior to making any investment decisions. And if you have a question that you want to run by Kevin, join in at 800-642-1234. You can send it via email on yourmoney@wpr.org. You can also tweet us at WPR Mornings. Let's go to Mike, who joins us in Madison. Hi, Mike.
Hi.
Go ahead.
I received some money as a gift from some relatives, and I'm wondering how I'm supposed to report that on my income tax.
Congratulations, Mike. Was it a payment for services rendered or anything like that, or just because you were born into the right family?
Well, it was sort of like being willed money, but the people that gave the money to me were my grandchildren, and it was out of their mother's estate.
Great. Well, and, very benevolent grandchildren. That's nice to hear. No, if it wasn't for anything you did in exchange for the money other than being born or having grandchildren, then no, you don't have to report it. Reporting only gets involved if the dollar amount given to you was greater than $15,000 per person in a given year. Was the money greater than that dollar amount?
No, each one of the grandchildren wrote a check for $14,000.
Okay. Yeah, they're smart grandchildren. They're not only benevolent, they're also intelligent, because that allows them to, the dollar amount last year was $14,000 that you could give to anyone without having to file a gift tax return. And if you had two people giving it to one person, sometimes it's more common when, say, you might have parents helping adult children purchase a home. They could give write a check for $14,000 to their daughter, let's say, and then that money could be used as a down payment for the home. In your case, you don't have to file any gift tax return, nor do the kids, as long as the dollar amount was below $14,000. So enjoy it and be thankful somebody did something right with those kids.
Well, Mike, thanks so much for the question and the call. There's a line for you at 800-642-1234. A listener named Zach says, I guess I'm too shy to call in. I have a 401k through work. They have an 8% match, and I'm currently contributing 10% of my pay. These are Roth contributions, by the way. Does this simply add up to an 18% contribution? I'm 35 years old. My 401k is about $147,000. I also have a Roth IRA that I put $200 per month in. That is sitting at around $27,000. I guess I'm wondering, what kind of track am I on? Is this good, or should I try to contribute more? More is always good, but I also need to save to have cash on hand for my home and upcoming marriage and kids.
What a planner. Huh?
Yeah, yeah.
I think Zach just, and rightfully so, just wrote in to brag. and well, he should. Good job, Zach. You're doing fantastic. First of all, to address your question about the contribution rate, with an 8% match, generally what a company says when they say we will give you contributions to your retirement account in the form of an 8% match, they're saying we will give you a certain dollar amount for every dollar amount you put in to your salary up to 8% of your salary. So if you make, let's say, $40,000 a year, and that's an 8% match, for the first $3,200 that you put in, they'll match that. And sometimes it's maybe just 25 cents on every dollar you put in, but other times it's 50 cents or even a dollar. So if you're out there and you have an employer who offers this very nice benefit, please beg, borrow, and steal any money you can to make sure you get the match. And then back to Zach's question about how he's doing. he's doing fantastic. The median 401k balance in America right now is probably about $110,000, and that's for all ages of workers. For someone as young as Zach, it's fantastic. According to Vanguard, workers who they have, and they have millions of workers in their 401k plans, for 25 to 34, the average balance of 401k accounts for those young workers is $22,000, and the median, meaning half is greater and half is less than this, is $8,600. So Zach's $147,000 is way over his age bracket. And even if he stops right now and earns 6% a year hypothetically, by the time Zach is 65, his $147,000 would be worth $844,000, assuming he doesn't contribute any more money whatsoever. And those of you who are out there listening, all the young adults who listen to On Your Money, it's a good lesson. The first thing you should do once you become a young adult is try to save as much money as possible into your 401k plan. You're better saving a ton in your 20s and stopping than you are waiting until your 30s and 40s.
What are some other steps that Zach should be taking?
It sounds like he's probably in a higher tax bracket. Sounds like he's also single, and therefore he may be better off saving into a pre-tax 401k rather than the Roth 401k. If he has more than $50,000 of gross income, the tax benefit of saving into a pre-tax plan is probably better than getting it tax-free in the Roth 401k in retirement. And after marriage, especially if his partner or spouse doesn't work, they'll be filing jointly, they'll be in a lower income tax rate, and then may be a better time to do more in the Roth 401k and Roth IRA.
What about saving for other goals besides retirement? He mentioned, you know, marriage and kids.
Yeah, that's a good point. I'd like him, actually, if he's concerned about these near-term goals, actually, he can afford to stop saving in his 401k because he's accumulated so much so far, and instead check off some shorter-term goals, like putting aside 3 to 6 months' worth of living expenses, start saving for a down payment of a house. That should usually be about 20% of the purchase price. So on a $200,000 house, that could be $40,000. If he's going to have a spouse and children, he's probably going to need life insurance, and I'd probably like to have about $1 million per parent on each parent if they can, with term life insurance. And even for someone in their 30s, you can probably plan on spending about $30 a month on that for a term life insurance policy for a female, and maybe $40 a month on that for a male for a 20 or 25 year term life insurance policy.
You're with us for another edition of On Your Money. Kevin McKinley is tackling your pressing money matters. He's a financial planner and managing member of McKinley Money LLC. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What question do you have for Kevin? How is your money-related resolution working out for you in 2018? Let's talk about it at 800-642-1234. You can email us onyourmoney@wpr.org. We'll be back to the conversation in just a moment here on the Ideas Network. Monday, January 29th, was the first day the IRS started accepting 2017 tax returns. The tax filing deadline this year falls on April 17th, and on this edition of On Your Money, we're learning about some key moves you can make during tax season. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Kevin McKinley is a financial planner and managing member of McKinley Money LLC. Taking your questions, your financial questions, that's on your mind at 800-642-1234. You can tweet us at WPR Mornings. Did you make a financial resolution in 2018? How is it going? 800-642-1234. You can send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Let's go to Melissa in Milwaukee. Hi, Melissa.
Hello.
Hi, Melissa. Go ahead.
Okay. So my question is about my home. My husband and I own a home together, and we have a mortgage, obviously, on the home. And we both have differing opinions about whether or not we should sell our house and if we can, quote-unquote, afford to stay in the house. My husband wants to stay in the house because he thinks that we can't afford to move as far as, like, paying, you know, a realtor 6% and losing equity on what it would be in the future. And I say that we need to move because since we've moved into the house, we've gone about $20,000 in debt a year since we've been there. So now we have like about $50,000 in credit card debt, plus a $25,000 equity loan, and we've been there for like 5 years. And we both actually just got jobs where we have to travel, so we're like, our expenses are actually increasing as far as like gas money and stuff like that. So any help?
Yeah, Melissa, I'm really glad you asked about this, because there are millions of Americans who are going through the same questions and with worse situations than yours. And so you're right to ask about this, not for only for your own situation, but to help illustrate this to other people. A lot of people who get in this situation feel like they're the only ones out there. Looks like everybody else has everything figured out financially, and they have all the money in the world, and why are we struggling with this? And truth of the matter is, it's just very hard to get by in America. And we've talked about this before, but Bankrate, the website, has done a survey where they've found that the average American cannot come up with $500 for a car repair bill for an emergency. They don't even have $500 in savings. And what happens is life is a series of emergencies, especially when it comes to money. And as those emergencies come up, you have no choice really to go into debt. So what I would do, first of all, Can you look at your situation, Melissa, and can you identify the reasons going back of what you spent the money on to get this deep in credit card debt?
Well, So we went from a house that was worth like $170,000 to a house that was worth about $355,000. Mm-hmm. So we really upscaled as far as like the size of the house. And I think something we didn't anticipate was the sort of cost for upkeep and maintenance when you do that kind of upgrade,
right,
when you're buying a house. So we had to get a roof and, you know, like every single appliance and every single like furnace and boiler and a water heater. And we have three furnaces and, you know, like everything just went completely, like we had to replace everything.
Wow.
And refrigerators and everything. Okay. So, because the house was not very well kept, mm-hmm, when we bought it. So that was definitely one thing. So that's probably, honestly, about $40,000 out,
okay,
the door just for that kind of stuff. But then, you know, just basic life stuff, you know, and us getting these jobs where I'm traveling south and he's traveling north every day, and both of us have, I have like a 2-hour drive and he has like a 1-hour drive. So then gas money. I'm probably spending like $500 a month in gas. He's probably spending like $300 or $400. So.
And that's not reimbursed by your employer, obviously, right?
No.
Okay. Well, actually, one of the things that I'm sorry to hear this, but it's one of the things that's actually reassuring to me, is that you can identify. Now, it obviously was maybe more expensive than you planned or than it should have been to purchase and upgrade this home, but at least you can go back and point to certain instances where this was something we had to do, and we had to spend the money on it. We didn't have the money, so we had to borrow it, and now we're kind of in trouble for it. And the problem comes, of course, Melissa, is not when things are going well and you and your husband both have jobs that are expensive to commute to, but it's with when either or both of you lose those jobs. And inevitably you will. You'll quit or retire or get fired. That happens to all of us. So the question that you have about going back to the house, you know, your husband is correct. It's expensive to sell a home. You pay commissions for it. You don't know what you're going to get. And then you have to go out and buy a new one as well. And unless you find the perfect home that's already set up, you're going to have those same kinds of expenses again. Can you afford, assuming you don't have any new expenses, can you basically afford the mortgage payment and property taxes of your current place?
It's a really expensive mortgage. You went from like a $1,400 mortgage to like a $2,400 mortgage.
Right.
And mm-hmm. my thought is, it's a pretty quick fix to go from a house that's, you know, about the size that it is now to maybe just somewhere in the middle, get a couple $100 back a month and, you know, maybe be able to like break even rather than like getting further in debt every month.
Yeah, that's what I would base your decision on, is to say, now that we've done this work, is it possible, can we kind of keep our head above water, put a little money aside, and then pay down all of this debt? And if you say yes, then you can probably stick it out. But if you say no, even if everything is fine, we're still just not making enough money, especially with all the mileage cost, to just break even. You're right. You're only going to keep digging the hole. And I don't believe that the equity in the home is going to be worth it enough to stay in this particular situation. Do you have equity established in it, or do you owe now more than you think the house is worth?
No, we actually do have equity because the house was kind of undervalued when we bought it. It was right. Undervalued because, as I mentioned, it was not being upkept very well.
Right.
But then we also did like a small renovation on it. So we probably the equity loan that we got was the $25,000, mm-hmm. but we probably have $100,000 in equity. So I'd say about like a $75,000.
Have you been to your credit union or bank to explain your situation to them and see what they can do?
No.
Okay, do that first. Go back in there and say, hey, we put this money into the house for all this, and we think it's worth more now than we purchased it. And therefore, we would like to see if we can get the house reappraised and then also finance some of the difference so that instead of paying, 12 or 15 or 29% interest on the credit cards, you can get maybe 4% or 5% interest on a new 30-year fixed rate mortgage, which will lower your expenses for it. And even if they'll let you do that, I'm not sure you should stay there, but that would be my first thing to do, especially if you can then stop the hemorrhage of cash from your situation and get back down below your income in terms of your spending.
Melissa, thanks so much for sharing and asking this important question. Good luck. Let's go to Colleen now in Cumberland. Hi, Colleen.
Hi. My question is, I'd like Kevin's thoughts on credit cards. We have a daughter graduating from college this spring, and she's wondering if it would be prudent to get a credit card so that she would have some credit rating started.
Absolutely, she should. And in Colleen, acknowledging that she's an adult, maybe in number of years only, do you expect her to be responsible with that credit card?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah, I definitely would get one. And if she can't get one on her own because she doesn't have a credit history or an earnings history, you might want to consider adding her to your credit account for a while and making her an authorized user. And you don't even have to give her the card. It just puts your credit habits on her credit history and helps her develop that so that in 6 or 12 months of responsible use by you, she might have a better chance of getting a credit card on her own.
And how do I go about doing that?
Contact the credit card company. You won't be the first person to call today and make that request. And just say, I have an adult daughter and I want to put her on the credit card. And they'll explain the different options that you have. Now, keep in mind, if you do give her a card and she charges something on there and can't pay it back, you will be responsible for it. So that's why I asked if you trust her to be responsible with it so that she doesn't then drive you deeper into debt.
Well, Colleen, thanks so much for asking the question. The April tax filing deadline is about 10 weeks away, but it's time to start planning for some money moves to make before that date.
Yeah, let's start, Kate, with the IRA and Roth IRA contributions. It's not as simple as some people might think. There are lots of restrictions. You can only put in $5,500 or your earnings, whichever is less. If you're over 50 for 2017, you can put in $6,500. If you have a plan at work, you can't contribute to a tax-deductible IRA unless your income is low, usually in the $50,000 range, give or take. And if you earn too much, you can't contribute to a Roth IRA. That's usually about $200,000. Or so for a married couple filing jointly. There's an age limit. You can't contribute to a tax-deductible IRA if you're over 70 and a half, but there also are some opportunities that many people aren't aware of as well.
So what are those opportunities?
Well, for instance, if you have a non-working spouse, and by non-working, I don't mean someone who doesn't do anything. I mean someone who doesn't get paid to do what they do, maybe around the house. You can still make contributions for that person. It's just twice the dollar amount. So if you make $11,000 and you have a stay-at-home spouse, you can put in $5,500 for yourself, to an IRA or Roth IRA plus another $5,500 for that spouse, even though he or she didn't have any earned income. Also, if you have a teenager who's had a job in 2017 and had legitimate earnings, you can then take that money and put it into a Roth IRA. And if she isn't responsible enough or willing to do it, you can put your own money into that account for her. Just remember, it's a gift, so it's her money to do with what she pleases.
So assuming one can make a contribution to an IRA and a Roth IRA, how should they choose between the two?
Yeah, the more income you have and the less need you have for the money, the better off it is to get the tax break that you'd get from the IRA. You get a tax break now, and then you'll likely be in a lower income tax bracket in retirement when you pull the money out. But if you are in the opposite of that situation, meaning you're in relatively low income tax bracket right now, or you really need the money in the next few years for emergencies, you'd rather have a Roth IRA. You get tax-free withdrawals in retirement, but before you retire, you can always pull the contributions back out of the Roth IRA with no taxes or penalty whatsoever for any reason at any time.
So what's the best way to invest the money in the IRA or the Roth IRA, for that matter?
Again, if you're going to need it, like you're putting it in a Roth IRA and it's kind of your rainy day fund, you probably need to keep at least half of it safe. It's not going to earn very much for you, but it's not going to be at risk. So just a money market account or maybe some shorter term CDs. If you think that you're not going to have a need for it, you might want to use an index fund like Vanguard's fund, where they have like a total stock market index fund that's very low cost fund. And finally, if you're kind of in between that, consider what's known as a target date fund. And that's a fund that picks a year off into the distance. This might be the year that you plan to retire, like you'll turn 62 and let's say the year 2040. You might look at an index fund that has 2040 in the name. And that has a combination of stock mutual funds, bond mutual funds, and money market accounts. And then as the year 2040, for this example, draws closer, it gradually moves money from the stock market mutual funds into the bond funds and into the money market, ostensibly growing more conservative. You can still lose money on it, but there hopefully won't be as much volatility in it in the final years when you're getting closer to the need for the money.
You're listening to On Your Money, getting insights on your money-related questions. Kevin McKinley is here, a financial planner and managing member of McKinley Money, LLC. You can join in with your financial question at 800-642-1234. What money question do you want to run by Kevin? Call in or email onyourmoney@wpr.org. You can tweet us at WPR Mornings. Let's go to Andrew now, who joins us from Green Bay. Hi, Andrew.
Hi there. So thanks for taking the call. I plan on buying into the company that I work for in the next somewhere between 3 and 7 years. I'll have the opportunity to buy us a good portion of where I work. And I'm wondering how I should be saving for that. Should I be saving for retirement or not at all? Should I be saving every penny and squirreling that away to put into the business? I likely won't have enough cash on hand to make that full purchase, so I'll probably be taking a loan for that. And then after I buy a portion of the business, do I save for retirement or do I just put that money into the business and assume that is my retirement?
Andrew, is it a publicly traded company or privately held?
It is not.
It's not. Okay. How many employees does the company have, just out of curiosity?
Usually less than 10. You know, it fluctuates a little bit, somewhere between 8 and 10 employees.
Okay. And what percentage of the company will you own when your transaction is complete?
Half.
Half. Okay. Good. This is more millionaires are created by owning small businesses than by any other, in my opinion, all other methods combined. The stock market notwithstanding, we're in a bubble right now. It's created a lot of millionaires who won't be millionaires in tomorrow or 6 months from now or 5 years from now. So I'm a big believer in buying into companies at which you work. You have more knowledge of that company. You know, you could go out and buy Apple stock or Amazon or whatever. You have no knowledge of what's going on at those companies other than what they tell you, and you have no control over it whatsoever. So I agree into buying into a company that you work at and that you believe in, and especially if you can get 50% of it. That's a significant control over the company for it. The problem that you run into, Andrew, is when it's your only asset. And so what I would do is definitely take the opportunity to buy it. If you believe in buying it, go right ahead and do it. Build the money up in a safe account, not in a risky account, and like a savings account or CDs, et cetera. And if you do need to borrow it, especially if you can borrow, you know, against your home and you're willing to bet your home equity on this purchase, that's something I'm okay with. But what I'd like you to do then is try to put every other penny you have into something else that not only has nothing to do with your company, but isn't even really economically sensitive. I'd want you to keep it very safe, because now, once you buy into this company, your income is going to be tied to the company's fortunes, your benefits. You probably get health insurance through the company, right?
I do not, actually, through my wife.
Oh, okay, good. Well, then that reduces the risk a little bit. But a lot of your well-being is already tied up into your income from the company. You'd hate to have things go south and both your income be jeopardized and your investment in the company jeopardized as well. So I'd like you to be as conservative as you can with all other dollars, because this is your new stock. This is your big bet. You didn't bet on red or black. You bet on 32 or whatever on the roulette. And the good news is, like I said, you have a lot of knowledge and control over what number might come up, but it's still just one number. It's not a diversified portfolio, so therefore you want to be as conservative as you can with all other investments and money until you build up enough where you can say, hey, if the company value goes to zero tomorrow, it would be a shame and a disappointment, but we wouldn't starve.
Andrew, good luck. Thank you so much for calling in with that question. Let's now go to Vern in Coleman. Hi, Vern.
Hi. Thanks for taking the call, long-time listener. In September and then this past January, I made a deposit to my Roth IRA, basically $2,000. I'm under all the other limits. Turns out this year I'm going to owe more taxes than I've sent in. I was looking at possibility, can I take that money out of the Roth and start a regular IRA? Then my other problem is my insurance company, who I started it with, no longer services American Funds, and American Funds say, hey, you need to go through your advisor to make the change. And it's like, all right, now I'm set with no financial advisor to make the change, and that's kind of my dilemma currently.
Right, and I'm sorry, Vern, go back. The reason why you want to transfer or do a regular IRA instead of a Roth IRA is why?
If I did my numbers right, I think if I put it into a regular IRA, I would be able to deduct that off my income.
Yeah.
On the, which I think would save me about $280.
Right. Yeah. What you might find, and keep in mind, it's nice, and that's a good tax benefit, a good reason to think of it. Keep in mind, you're going to pay taxes on it in retirement when you pull the money out from the regular IRA. Probably not at the rate at which you're saving right now, because most retirees, or at least the majority of retirees, are in a lower tax bracket in retirement than they are when they're working. But you're going to pay taxes on it. So let's just say the tax bill on that withdrawal is going to be $150. Well, yes, you save the money now, but you pay it later, and you have to decide if the tax savings you'll get is worth all the extra work of going through the forms and filling everything out, rather than saying, well, I'll tell you what, I've learned my lesson, now I'll start with a regular IRA for future contributions. If you still decide that, and you go ahead, call American Funds back up and tell them your situation. Say, I don't have a financial advisor, I still want to make this transaction. They can send you the forms directly to do it, hopefully. But again, this is one of the disadvantages of buying broker-sold mutual funds and investments. You have to have somebody there who's willing to help you afterwards, and they can't always guarantee they'll be to do it.
Well, Vern, thank you so much for calling in with that question. You are with us for another edition of On Your Money. We're getting insights on the money questions in your life. Kevin McKinley is a financial planner and managing member of McKinley Money, LLC. You can join in with your question at 800-642-1234. What money question do you want to run by Kevin? Call in or email onyourmoney@wpr.org. We'll be back in just a moment here on the Ideas Network.
My mama told me, you better shop around. Oh, yeah, you better shop around. Shop around.
Bank of America faced widespread criticism recently for its decision to eliminate a no-fee checking account it had long offered to customers who do all their banking online or at ATMs. We're talking about what to look for in an online bank on this edition of On Your Money. Kevin McKinley is a financial planner and managing member of McKinley Money, LLC. You can join in with your personal finance question for Kevin at 800-642-1234. You can also email your question to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Tweet us at WPR Mornings. A listener named Megan says, "Hi, Kevin and Kate. I've been looking at online savings accounts and have had a hard time committing to a specific bank. They all seem about the same, but I'm nervous about transferring the money from my real bank," quotes there, "to an online account. I want to take advantage of their higher interest rates and still be able to have cash available for emergencies, etc. Are there any specific online savings accounts or banks that you would recommend? What should I watch out for when making this decision? And thanks for your always savvy advice. I've enjoyed listening to your show for several years now, and it's my favorite on WPR."
Obviously, she actually has listened before because she realizes the benefit of false praise, and it makes it much more likely that she'll get her question answered on the air. And it's a growing area of finance. There's lower costs to online banking. They don't have as many buildings. Their employee staffing is different, can be more scalable. And generally, what you hope is the online bank or credit union would then pay off with higher yields and lower interest rates on loans. And because it's more scalable, they would still be able to make the profits that they need to make to pay their shareholders and stay in business. But there are a couple things to keep in mind if you are going to move to an online bank.
And so what should Megan be watching out for?
Some of them have really great offers of really good loans or deposit accounts or CDs that have fantastic interest rates. And I'm a big believer that if it's FDIC insured, a bank is a bank is a bank, and a credit union has the same level of safety and government insurance. So it kind of is a commodity. So sometimes when these rates are so high, you wonder, well, why is this such a good deal? And it can mean just that they're trying to attract new depositors or new deposits. But other times it can mean there's a gotcha where they say, "We're going to give you 2% on a 5-year CD, but you have to have 10 debit card transactions every single month. And if you ever drop below that 10 figure for the month, then we're going to have to start billing you with a $50 monthly fee." Or they say you have to keep at least $100,000 in the account at all times. Or you have to have direct deposit in it. And all that's fine. They get to set their terms, but you need to know what those terms are to get these great rates. So you know if you run afoul of them, you might actually lose the interest rate. So make sure that she understands what those gotchas could be. Also, understand that there is kind of a delay in working together. If you're moving money back and forth to it, you can wire it electronically, but that's not as instantaneous as a lot of people would believe, because sometimes institutions don't credit accounts just because the money is there. They want to know that it's actually good in the account. They call it maturing in the account or aging in the account. You are going to be on the phone with a call center rather than stopping by your local branch to resolve any issues for it. And the biggest issue for fraud is not that, you know, the bank itself might steal your money or run away with it. It's more that you will be fooled by spam or phishing emails that purport to be the institution you're working with, and you'll click on an email that looks like it comes from your online bank, but it's not, and you'll enter in information and give it to the spammers or the crooks, and they'll then use that information to try to get at your account. So if you ever get any contact from this online bank via email, rather than clicking on the links, if it looks suspicious at all, log out of the email and then go directly to the website, type it into the bar itself, and then log into your account that way. And that'll make it more likely that you're actually logging into your proper account.
Are there some bigger or better online banks out there?
Bankrate.com says 5 of the best ones that they've analyzed along with Money Magazine are Ally Bank, Everbank, Discover, Charles Schwab, which is a very large investment firm, but also has a online bank as well, and then Bank of Internet, which is a really good name for an internet bank.
What about the ethics of working with an online bank?
Yeah, a lot of people are concerned. They say, you know, I want to keep my money local. And there's definitely some merit to that. But keep in mind that just because you have deposits at your local credit union or bank, that money isn't necessarily stay in the community. They might invest in treasury securities or stocks or bonds, or they might make loans that have nothing to do with the community. It's more likely to stay in there than it is with an online bank, but not necessarily so just because the geographic location. That local bank or credit union also supports the community. It employs people in the community as well and pays taxes in many cases in the community. So it does help your local community, but they often aren't very competitive on the interest rates that they pay and the interest rates that they charge for loans. And so what you might want to do is if you find that you are making a better yield on your deposits at an online bank, maybe take a little bit of that money and donate it to some causes that the local bank or credit union might have otherwise given to.
If you have a personal finance question for Kevin McKinley, there's still time for you. There's a line for you at 800-642-1234. You can send your question by email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. You can tweet us at WPR Mornings. Let's go to Jeremy now, who joins us from Appleton. Hi, Jeremy.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning.
Thank you for taking my call. I have a question regarding previous employer-sponsored retirement accounts and kind of what would be best for me to do moving forward. In a general sense, I have three employer-sponsored 401k accounts from previous employers, so they're still earning interest, et cetera, but I'm not actively funding those. I also have a previous IRA from a fourth previous employer. So I have four accounts. They're not actively being funded. Question is, I'm now self-employed. I'm consulting. So I'm not actively funding my retirement, but I want to start actively doing that. So the question really is, are there ways that I could potentially consolidate those previous accounts? Would that be advantageous? And if so, how might I do that?
You can consolidate them, and you often can consolidate it into your own self-directed IRA, or sometimes the 401k provider will allow you to move other employer-sponsored plan account balances into their particular 401k. The question is, should you do that? And I'd be very cautious about it for a couple of reasons, one of which is the previous 401ks might have better fund options than what you can get on your own. Typically, that's not the case unless there's what's known as a stable value or fixed rate account. Those are generally only available in 401k and 403b plans. You can't go out and get it on your own. And once you pull the money away from the 401k provider who offers an investment like that, you generally can't put it back in. And this would be like a fixed account that maybe pays 2 or 3% a year, Jeremy. So I'd be cautious of pulling it out of a plan that offers that account, because that's not as safe as an account as they would lead you to believe, but it's still a very safe account. It's not as safe as a CD, but it's pretty good. So I'd be cautious about that. And then the second thing is, there's a provision in the IRS regulations that allows people who have separated from service from a previous employer and reached age 55 to pull money out of the 401k and live off of it and pay taxes, but not pay any 10% penalty for early withdrawal that you'd otherwise receive from an IRA. So if you're getting close to 55 and you think you might need that money, you might want to leave some of it in the 401k, because it's easier to get at without a penalty than it is when you roll it over to an IRA. But some people just like having an IRA because they've just one account, or they have better investment options in the IRA so that that they can go after other types of investments that they can't get in their 401k. They might want to buy stocks. They might want to buy CDs. And usually you can't buy individual stocks or CDs within a 401k, but you can with an IRA. So just weigh all those different things out. And then if you find someone who can help you, like a financial advisor, talk to him or her and they'll do the work for you. They should do it anyway. Or if you're going to set it up yourself at your current IRA custodian, or you have a Vanguard, a Schwab, a Fidelity, TD Ameritrade, they transfer billions of dollars every single day from old 401ks into new IRAs.
Well, Jeremy, good luck. Appreciate the call to On Your Money. Let us go now to Robert, who joins us in Madison. Hi, Robert.
Hi. I was wondering to see if you had an opinion about whether to put money into a Roth IRA or pay off some student loans. I have like a mortgage at 4.25%, and it's in some student loans at 6.25%. and I'm 40, and I was thinking to perhaps put it in a Roth IRA instead, but it also seems like the market is, I wouldn't be surprised if there's like a bubble.
Mm-hmm.
So I was thinking to pay down maybe my student loans, but I don't know. I've been asking people what they think.
And we just happened to come up on your radar screen, so in your survey that you decided to check with us, Robert. Yeah, I actually agree with you, and here's something to think about with the student loans, especially relative to a Roth IRA, because if you were to contribute that money to an IRA instead, at least you would get a tax break on the deposit. The tax break is kind of short-lived, meaning you get it now, and then you pay taxes on the distribution when you pull it out in retirement. But with a Roth IRA, you don't get any tax break on it, so it really doesn't save you money. It's only can it make you money going forward. And then weighing it out versus the cost of the loans, you know, your student loan is 6.25%. If you're weighing out the difference between depositing to a Roth IRA or paying off student loan, you'd have to make 6.25% per year in that Roth IRA, guaranteed on whatever you invest in, to have it offset the cost of the loan. Plus, having that loan outstanding is costing in the form of a lower credit rating, which then can cost you money in insurance premiums and homeowners premiums insurance. So, yeah, I'd much rather have you at this point in your life and based on your situation, I'd much rather have you pay off those student loans. Don't pay the mortgage off any faster than you have to. Just make the minimum payment on that. If you can finally get the student loans retired, then that's the time to start contributing to a Roth IRA, IRA, or 401k.
Well, Robert, thank you so much for the call. And we're going to close with Mary's email. I listen to you every week for your clever quips and financial perspective. My 10-year-old has sold items she makes, such as the very popular slime. Can I put the money she earns, about $500, into a Roth IRA?
Kate, do your children...
We like slime.
They're slime manufacturers.
We do, but we follow a book on slime.
Okay, you don't go after YouTube slime experts?
We're not slime on Etsy or anything.
Yeah, but my daughter, my 13-year-old, is so into it that she actually gives bleach as a gift to her friends. Like a gallon of bleach. I said, why
is it
are
organic?
We make our own bleach at home. It's
nice.
It's artisanal bleach. She gives it off to her friends because she was so into it, and she would give little tutorials to her other friends on video. And I said, you should make some money doing this. A lot of kids are making money selling slime or doing YouTube videos. And she said, Dad, I do it because I love helping people.
Wow.
Well, I said, there's a lot of better ways to help people than teaching them how to make slime. But good for Mary's child. And yes, you can use that money, the earnings from that, to make a Roth IRA contribution. And I would highly recommend you do so. It's tricky to find a Roth IRA custodian who will open one for someone who's that young and with that low dollar amount. But I'd try Vanguard and see what they say about it.
Well, Mary, good luck with that slime and turning it into saved dollars. Kevin, what is the website of the week?
Well, as you well know, and you've probably been celebrating it around your house, Kate, January is National Radon Action Month. Radon is the second leading cause of lung cancer, and over 20,000 Americans die each year from it. And the Department of Health Services in Wisconsin and the EPA both have websites to educate you on radon. You can order a $20 testing kit, and if you do have a problem with it, it costs about $500 to $1,500. Dollars to fix, but it can also delay the sale of a home if you're thinking of doing it down the road, and it can take a long time to set up mediation for it or remediation for it. So we'll have the websites up to get information on how to check to see if you have a radon problem in your house and how to fix it at onyourmoney.com later on today.
Well, radon, a serious matter and a money matter. And four more words before we go.
Spend less, have more.
Kevin McKinley is a financial planner and managing member of McKinley Money LLC. On Your Money can be heard on the Ideas Network Tuesday mornings at 8. It's rebroadcast Saturdays at noon. This edition of On Your Money was produced by Chris Molina and Bill Martins. Dave Potras provided technical direction. Michelle Johnson is executive producer. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, and On Your Money can be found on the Ideas Network.